Okay, welcome. My name is Divine. This is episode 332 of the Divine Intervention Podcast. And in this podcast, I'm going to be talking about pleural abnormalities and the USMLE exams. Pleural abnormalities and the USMLE exams. This podcast is just one of these podcasts where the topic sounds very benign, but it's actually, this is probably going to be one of my easy, like top 15 highest yield podcasts that I've ever made. This topic, the NBME actually finds some nice ways to test this information. So this is something I definitely recommend keeping in mind if I were you. This is something that you should absolutely expect to see a question or two. Actually, many times it'll be more than two questions on an exam, both step one, step two, CK, step three, right? So it's just something you want to keep at the back of your mind for tests. So this podcast, before I go into it, as I say at the beginning of every podcast, if you're studying for the USMLE Step 2 CK or Step 3 exams, I know there's many people taking these exams over the next few weeks here, you know, ahead of the ERAS application deadline. I do offer an MBME test taking strategies course that's taking place next week, Thursday. It's from 2 to 4:30 p.m. Pacific Standard Time. And we'll basically use a bunch of questions because for me, I like to be a very practical person. So use a bunch of questions to talk about how to answer NBME questions. We'll talk about how to read NBME questions, the key pieces of information to pay attention to in NBME questions, the way to avoid traps that the NBME classically sets for people. We'll also talk about how to answer ethics questions. We'll talk about how to answer questions even if you're not completely sure of the material presented, right? We'll talk about lots of very practical high fidelity techniques for improving your scores on NBME exams. Again, I've had many people take these courses. Like literally, there's a recent example of someone that took the NBME test taking strategies course, and a few days later they took a practice test and they bumped up by like almost 30 points, right? So these test taking strategies, they really help, because the thing is, the NBMEs, they're very consistent in the way they set up questions, right? So if you have a deep understanding of how they set up questions, you'll find it a much easier time like answering those questions correctly. And then I have a comprehensive review course taking place on Friday and Saturday next week. So that's the 13th and 14th of August. And in that course, we'll cover peds, surgery, internal medicine, OB-GYN, psych, neuro, biostats, ethics, communications, professionalism, multi-system processes and disorders. Again, I've had many people take these courses and do extremely well on their exams. So if you're interested, just shoot me an email through the website and I'll give you some more information on cost. The courses are held over Zoom, but again, they've been very well received. The very vast majority of people that have taken these courses have done really well. Okay, so this pleural abnormalities podcast, I think the first thing to kind of go into is, I'm basically going to be, again, just to keep myself organized, I'm going to be answering different questions as I go through this, right? So the first thing is, what is a pleural effusion? Well, remember, we know what a pleural effusion is, right? A pleural effusion basically is whenever you have a fluid collection between the visceral and parietal pleuras, because we know that the lungs has a pouch, right? Each lung has a pouch. It's encased by visceral pleura, and then on the outside of that, we have the parietal pleura. So if fluid collects there, that's going to be a pleural effusion, right? So that's one key thing you want to know about a pleural effusion. Now, the second thing I would like to talk about with pleural effusions are, what are the classic physical exam findings in a person that has a pleural effusion? Well, obviously, there's going to be fluid, right, between the different pleural layers. So we know that sound transmission is going to be limited, right? So you're going to have decreased breath sounds when a person has a pleural effusion, right? And then that person's lungs will obviously be dull to percussion on exam, right? So if you think about it, if you take an empty bottle and bang on the bottle, you get more noise from it than a bottle that's full, right? And then you're also going to have a decrease in your tactile frimitus, right? And you have a pleural effusion. So that's just something general to keep in mind, right? So decreased tactile frimitus, dullness to percussion, and decreased breath sounds. So that's the second thing. Now, the third thing is, how do you diagnose a pleural effusion? Well, many times you diagnose it with imaging, right? So many times if you get a chest x-ray, I mean, obviously the gold standard is a chest CT, right? But you really shouldn't be getting a chest CT for a pleural effusion on an NBME exam, right? You should get a chest x-ray, right? Most times the chest x-ray will show you like the blunting of the costophrenic angles. Although, if you want to even improve the sensitivity of that chest x-ray some more, one thing you can do is you can do a decubitus chest x-ray, right? Because that will make the fluid layer and actually helps you detect pleural effusions that have much smaller volumes. And most times, if you have a small pleural effusion, you're not going to get much in the way of symptoms until you get about 300 milliliters, roughly, of pleural fluid. That's where you begin to become symptomatic. Now, the fourth thing I'll go into, because I want to try to keep this podcast as short as possible, because there are many different ways a person can really go with this, is what are the two kinds of pleural effusions, right? What are the two kinds of pleural effusions? Well, and I'm going to discuss mechanisms, right? Because again, many of these things, they're just things, if you understand them, then you don't need to sit down willy-nilly memorizing tons and tons and tons of information, right? So the first kind of a pleural effusion is a transudative effusion, okay? First kind of pleural effusion is a transudative effusion. And a transudative effusion, the key thing I will say is, this usually arises from processes that are outside of the lungs. If you keep that in mind, that will really help you triage the different causes of a pleural effusion, right? But a transudative pleural effusion arises from problems that are outside the lung, right? Versus an exudative effusion, it usually happens from problems that are local, that are native to the lung, right? But let me say some more things about a transudative effusion. When people have transudative effusions, it usually arises, again, like I said, from problems outside the lungs. And those problems can come in two categories. One is problems in the body, like systemic problems that increase your hydrostatic pressures. Two, you can also get them from systemic problems that decrease your oncotic pressures, right? So basically, things that modulate the Starling forces in the body systemically can cause a transudative pleural effusion. So what are those things? Well, think about it. For example, if a person has congestive heart failure, right? That's a problem outside of the lungs. The thing that happens is the hydrostatic pressures in your pulmonary capillaries will be increased, and that's going to cause extravasation of fluid, right? So obviously, in those circumstances, the person is going to have a pleural effusion. They're going to have a transudative pleural effusion, right? Another classic one, right, if we're looking from oncotic pressure perspectives, if a person has like nephrotic syndrome, well, you're urinating a lot of protein in your urine, right? Remember, proteins like albumin are responsible for holding on to the pressures, right? They contribute to the oncotic pressures of your bloodstream, right? So if you're getting rid of all that protein, then there's nothing to hold on to fluid in your vascular tree. You're going to be, that's going to cause more fluid extravasation. And that's ultimately going to lead to the person having a transudative effusion, right? Or think about it. What's the organ that produces albumin in your body? That's going to be your liver, right? If your liver doesn't work, if you have cirrhosis, right? Again, protein in your body is going to go down. That's going to decrease your oncotic pressure. That's going to cause a transudative pleural effusion. Or if a person has like kwashiorkor, right? These kids are not consuming protein, right? If you don't consume protein, again, that's going to decrease the amount of protein in your body. That's going to lower your oncotic pressure, right? Or if a person has Ménétrier's disease, right? Whenever you have these protein-losing gastropathies like Ménétrier's disease or Cronkite Canada syndrome, in those circumstances, right, you're getting rid of protein, this time for the most part in your poop, in your stool. So in those circumstances, again, that's going to decrease the oncotic pressure of your bloodstream, and that can cause a transudative pleural effusion, right? So those are all the things that in general, classically on NBM exams, can cause a transudative pleural effusion. And I want you to keep in mind that because these things are almost, these transudative effusions are almost like ultra filtrates, most times they are clear, right? So if you're seeing a lot of cells in a pleural effusion, you should probably not be considering that the individual has a transudative effusion. And also, if you notice that the glucose of that pleural effusion is less than 60, then you really should not be considering a transudative effusion. Most transudative effusions on NBM exams will have glucoses greater than 60 milligrams per deciliter. So that's the first major kind of effusion. That's a transudative effusion. Now, the next major kind of effusion is an exudative effusion, right? So for an exudative effusion, right, it's going to contain lots of cells, usually. It's going to contain many times a low glucose. The glucose usually is going to be less than 60 in an exudative effusion. A paraneumonic effusion, so an effusion that arises in the setting of pneumonia, is going to be an exudative effusion, right? Most times the things that cause exudative effusions are going to be like just straight up infection, right? So like a bacterial infection, a fungal infection, a viral infection, TB, right? And also cancer. Cancer loves to cause exudative effusions, right? So when people have malignant pleural effusions, those are going to be examples of exudative effusions. Now, pulmonary emboli are examples of exudative effusions. Whenever a person has a PE and you have a pleural effusion, that pleural effusion is going to be exudative, right? PEs do not cause transudative effusions. I'll say that again because that's a common misnomer. I've said that like years ago back in the day, that, oh, PEs can cause both transudative and exudative effusions. The answer to that is no, right? So more recent studies have actually shown that PEs cause exudative effusions, because the thing is, when you have a PE, you have all this inflammation happening, right? So you're releasing all these cytokines and things of that nature. Those cytokines, they're going to increase your vascular permeability, and that's going to cause like solids and stuff to leak into your pleural space, right? So the thing that happens with PEs is an exudative effusion, right? So exudative effusions, I want you to think of pulmonary emboli, cancers, right? So malignancies. I want you to think of infection. I want you to think of pneumonic effusions. I want you to think of TB. Those things all cause exudative effusions. But it would be really nice if there was some really nice way of differentiating a transudative effusion from an exudative effusion based on the information that you're given. Because many times when a person gets a pleural effusion, under ultrasound guidance, you're going to do a thoracentesis, right? When you do the thoracentesis, you get fluid and you send it off for analysis, right? So the thing that really helps in these circumstances is something called Light's criteria, right? Light's criteria. That's the job of Light's criteria, is to help you differentiate between a transudative and an exudative effusion, right? So how exactly does that work? Well, the way that works is, first things first, right? You're going to get information from the person's serum, right? And then you're also going to get information from the person's pleural effusion, right? And then you compare those things. The first thing is that the ratio from the pleural, so the pleural fluid protein to the serum protein, the ratio should be less than 0.5, right? Basically, all these criteria that I'm going to state, if you meet all three, then you're a transudative effusion. If you violate, even if it's just one, then you're an exudative effusion, right? So from the transudative effusion perspective, the ratio of the pleural fluid protein to the serum protein should be less than 0.5, right? An easy way to triage this is, if you notice that a person's pleural fluid protein is more than like 4 milligrams per day, let me put it this way. If a person's pleural fluid protein is more than like 3, then that usually tells you that the person has an exudative effusion, right? Because a normal serum protein usually is between like 6 and 8, roughly, although the MBMEs, they actually give you that value on exams, right? So the ratio between the pleural fluid protein to the serum protein should be less than 0.5 to be a transudative effusion. The second Light's criteria is that the ratio of the pleural fluid LDH to the serum LDH should be less than 0.6, right? Again, for you to be said to be a transudative effusion. And then the third criteria is that the pleural fluid LDH should be less than 2/3 the upper limit of normal of the serum LDH, right? So let me throw out a number here. So let's say that, again, I'm just making up numbers here. Let's say that, oh, the serum LDH is 90. Well, 2/3 of 90 is 60. The pleural fluid LDH has to be numerically less than 60 for you to say that the person has a transudative effusion. Again, you need to meet all three of Light's criteria to say that the person has a transudative pleural effusion. So again, just to rehash again, the pleural fluid protein to serum protein ratio should be less than 0.5. Second criteria, the pleural fluid LDH, so the serum LDH, that ratio should be less than 0.6. And then three, the pleural fluid LDH should be less than 2/3 the upper limit of normal of the serum LDH. You need to meet all three criteria to be called a transudative effusion. If you violate, even if it's just one of those criteria, you're dealing with an exudative effusion, right? So those are the two major types of effusions and how to tell them apart and the mechanisms that I want to discuss. Now, the fifth question I want to answer is, what are pneumonic effusions, right? So the key thing I think I want to say is that pneumonic effusions, look at the name, pneumonic. So it's parallel to a pneumonia, right? So a pneumonic effusion is an effusion that arises in the setting of pneumonia. If you see a person having a pneumonia and they have a pleural effusion, that's a pneumonic effusion. And by definition, a pneumonic effusion is a kind of exudative effusion. I'll say that again. A pneumonic effusion is a kind of exudative effusion, right? So that's the fifth question I want to answer. Now, because the thing is, most times, right, when people have pneumonia, right, they're releasing all these inflammatory factors because of the immune system cells that are there. So essentially, the thing that happens is that you're increasing vascular permeability, right? You're increasing vessel permeability. So again, solids and stuff are going to leak out, right? So you're going to get an exudative effusion from that perspective. Now, the sixth question I want to answer is, what are the types of pneumonic effusions, right? The thing is, there are three types. And unfortunately, many resources mishandle the proper classification of this. Believe it or not, even some Q banks mishandle the proper classification of paramnemonic effusions, right? So there are three types of paramnemonic effusions. There is the, and I'm going to list it from the least bad to the most bad. The least bad is an uncomplicated paramnemonic effusion. The middle ground one is the complicated paramnemonic effusion. And then the one that is really, really bad is an empyema, right? So let me tell you clearly on MBME exams how you differentiate between these three pathologies. Obviously, you're going to get thoracentesis, and then you're going to be looking at certain markers. You're going to be looking at the pH. You're going to be looking at the glucose. And then you're going to be looking at the presence or the absence of bugs, okay? So let me explain how this works. For an uncomplicated paramnemonic effusion, you're going to look, and the numbers you're remembering for pH are 7.2. The number you're remembering for glucose is 60. So for an uncomplicated paramnemonic effusion, the pH of that pleural fluid is going to be less than 7.2. Sorry, it's going to be greater than 7.2. So I'll say it again. For an uncomplicated paramnemonic effusion, the pH is going to be greater than 7.2. The glucose is going to be greater than 60, right? And the gram stain, you're not going to see any bugs. I'll say that again. For an uncomplicated paramnemonic effusion, the pH is going to be greater than 7.2. The glucose is going to be greater than 60. And you're not going to see any bugs on gram stain, right? That's an uncomplicated paramnemonic effusion. And the way you treat an uncomplicated paramnemonic effusion is essentially with antibiotics. That's it. You don't need to do thoracentesis for an uncomplicated paramnemonic effusion. Now, the next one on the ladder is a complicated paramnemonic effusion. It's actually very easy to remember what you'll find in a complicated paramnemonic effusion. For a complicated paramnemonic effusion, the pH basically just reverse the signs of the pH and the glucose that we said for an uncomplicated paramnemonic effusion. So for complicated paramnemonic effusion, the pH is going to be less than 7.2. The glucose is going to be less than 60, right? And most times, you're not going to find any bugs on gram stain. I'll say that again. Most times, you're not going to find any bugs on gram stain for a complicated paramnemonic effusion, right? And how do you treat a complicated paramnemonic effusion? You're going to basically give those people antibiotics. But in addition to that, you need to do some kind of thoracentesis. So again, for complicated paramnemonic effusion, the pH is going to be less than 7.2. The glucose is going to be less than 60. And usually, I'm not saying always, but usually you're not going to find any bugs on a gram stain, right? That's very important. That's very important. In fact, I will tell you this. I will say if I were taking an MBME exam, I would go with not seeing any bugs. I'll say that again. I would go with not seeing any bugs on a gram stain for complicated paramnemonic effusions. Now, for an empyema, basically an empyema is essentially the same thing as a complicated paramnemonic effusion, but you're going to see bugs for sure on a gram stain, right? So for an empyema, the pH is going to be less than 7.2. The glucose is going to be less than 60, and you're going to see bugs on a gram stain. In fact, let me just parse this out again, give you definitive information. For an uncomplicated paramnemonic effusion, the pH is going to be greater than 7.2, glucose is going to be greater than 60, you're not going to find any bugs on gram stain. And you treat that with just antibiotics. For complicated paramnemonic effusions, the pH is going to be less than 7.2, the glucose is going to be less than 60, and you're not going to find bugs on a gram stain. And you treat complicated paramnemonic effusions with antibiotics and thoracentesis. Now, for an empyema, the pH is going to be less than 7.2. The glucose is going to be less than 60. And on gram stain, you're going to find bugs. And you're usually going to treat that with antibiotics plus thoracentesis. And sometimes for empyemas, you may also have to do like decorticaion because sometimes the fluid is very like loculated and things like that, right? So that's how I'm going to parse those three kinds of paramnemonic effusions for you. Again, these things, I promise you, they're actually very high yield to know for exams, right? So now the seventh question I want to answer is, what are some special kinds of pleural effusions you may see on an MBME exam? Well, these are basically things where they will give you certain associations. And then based on those associations, you're like, oh, it must be this exact problem, right? So the first one is, if they give you a question about a person having a pleural effusion, and they tell you that it's foul smelling. If you see that, the first thing I want you to think about is that the person has an anaerobic pleural effusion. So foul smelling, because remember, anaerobes do a lot of fermentation. Fermentation smells, right? So if it's foul smelling, it's going to be an anaerob. Another classic one you may see on an exam is they may tell you that a person, you know, was in a motor vehicle accident, or they just had a surgical procedure done, or they were in some kind of trauma, And then you notice that they have a pleural effusion. And when you do a thoracentesis, you find like yellowish fluid and you see a lot of triglycerides, right? Like the triglyceride content is like more than 110. If you see that, I really want you to think about a chylothorax, right? Chylothorax. Chylothoraces usually contain chylomicrons, right? That's where the triglycerides are coming from. Most times, you get that from transecting the thoracic duct. Okay, I'll say that again. Most times, you get a chylothorax from transecting the thoracic duct. Now, what if you see a person having a pleural effusion and it's reddish and you see a lot of red blood cells? If you see that on an MBM exam, I want you to think of this person potentially having a hemothorax. And hemothoraces actually treated most times with thoracentesis, right? Thoracentesis, right? But one other thing that can cause hemorrhagic pleural effusions classically on MBM exams is a mesothelioma. Mesotheliomas love to cause hemorrhagic pleural effusions. And then another thing I want to say about pleural effusions, again, just special case situations, are if a person has a lung cancer and you notice that they have malignant cells in the pleural fluid, right? So many times they'll tell you that you see a lot of like mitotic figures, you see cells with very large nucleoli, stuff like that. When you see stuff like that, when a person has malignant cells in their pleural fluid, that's an example, that's a malignant pleural effusion, right? When people have malignant cells in pleural fluid and it's lung cancer, you can pretty much opine that those people have stage 4 lung cancer. I'll say that again. When a person has malignant cells in their pleural fluid and they have a lung nodule seen, those people have stage 4 lung cancer. Okay, now, what if they give you a question about a person, they have a pleural fluid, and in that pleural fluid, you see a lot of cells, and most of, like, you see a lot of white blood cells, and you see a lot of those cells being lymphocytes. And they tell you that, oh, the adenosine deaminase content of that pleural fluid is really high. If you see stuff like that, I want you to think of a person having tuberculosis-associated pleural effusion, okay? So high levels of adenosine deaminase, high levels of white blood cells with a predominance of lymphocytes, that's going to be a TB pleural effusion, right? Again, the fact that that pleural effusion is does not give you anything on acid fasting does not mean that it's not a tuberculosis pleural effusion. Right. And again, most times when people have malignant pleural effusions, most times it's usually going to be due to like lung cancer, breast cancer. Those are like the two most common malignant causes of pleural effusions. Right. But again, those malignant pleural effusions, most times the pH is going to be less than 7.2 and the glucose is going to be less than 60 just because of all the inflammation that is going on there. Right. And then if they give you a question about a person having an adnexal mass and a person has ascites, and then they have a pleural effusion, I want you to think of something called Meigs syndrome. Meigs syndrome is spelled M-E-I-G-S, right? Meigs syndrome. If you see stuff like that, if you see that triad of ascites and adnexal mass, so the person has an ovarian malignancy that is benign, and you notice that they have a pleural effusion, I absolutely want you to think about Meigs syndrome on a test. Now, one big thing I want to say is if they give you a question about a person that has had like some kind of like viral upper respiratory infection, and then you notice that not long after, they start having like very high fevers, really bad headaches, right? And then they tell you that they have like very severe pain, like in their lower chest, right? In fact, most times these people, when they breathe, if they breathe even just a little, right, they take in a deep breath or they exhale, it just hurts a ton. Whenever you see stuff like that, right, usually these people have to take like pauses, right, because their breathing just really hurts a lot. If you see that, I want you to think about pleurodynia, right? P-L-E-U-R-O-D-Y-N-I-A, pleurodynia, right? Another name you may see for pleurodynia on an MBM exam is something called Bornholm disease. Bornholm disease. Bornholm is spelled B, I won't be surprised if that's a Swedish term, but it's B-O-R-N-H-O-L-M. I'll say that again, B-O-R-N-H-O-L-M, okay? Bornholm disease, right? And for the most part, the way you're going to treat it is you're just going to go ahead and give NSAIDs, right? Give NSAIDs. Sometimes you can put like heat packs on the part of the body that's hurting. But for the most part, that's pretty much all you need to do for these people, right? That's pretty much all you need to do for these people. And if they're trying to give you like a bug that's causing this person's pleurodynia, think of Coxsackie B. Remember, Coxsackie B causes two things on MBM exam. First, it causes viral myocarditis. And then second, Coxsackie B loves to cause Coxsackie B many times loves to cause, again, this pleurodynia, right? But one thing that looks a lot like pleurodynia and is actually treated exactly the same way as pleurodynia is something called pleurisy, right? Pleurisy. Pleurisy, again, many times is going to be a person that has again, they've had like a viral upper respiratory infection. Virus is actually the most common cause. And again, they'll have this lancinating pain in their chest. And whenever they move their rib cage, let's say they're taking a deep breath or they exhale, it hurts a ton, right? And sometimes you may hear like a rub sound, or you may hear like a lancinating sound when they take deep breaths. If you see that, I want you to think of pleurisy. Pleurisy, again, is treated exactly the same way as pleurodynia, with NSAIDs, right? Another thing that also kind of looks like that, to be honest with you, I feel like these diseases are on a spectrum, right? Is something called pleuritis, right? Pleuritis, again, many times it can arise after an upper respiratory infection, like a viral URI, but it can also arise in people that have like, it can also arise in people that have like lupus, right? People that have these autoimmune diseases, right? Like lupus, Sjogren's, rheumatoid arthritis, right? And basically those people, again, they have inflammation of, especially in lupus, right? Those people tend to have inflammation of serosal surfaces, like the pleural surfaces, right? So those people, again, it will hurt when they are taking deep breaths, right? And again, most times the way you treat those people is with NSAIDs, right? And then the last pleural abnormality I'm going to talk about is mesothelioma, right? So remember, mesothelioma will cause like pleural thickening on an in-beam exam. The person may have worked in a shipyard, right? And again, most times mesotheliomas, right, they have really bad prognosis. And don't forget the association of the sarcoma bodies on NBM exams, right? Remember, those things are called laminated, or sometimes you may see them referred to as lamellated calcifications, right? And then asbestosis, many times you'll see pleural plaques, right? You'll see calcifications in the pleural walls. If you see stuff like that, I want you to think of asbestosis, okay? So I think that's all I'm going to say from a pleural abnormalities perspective. Again, as I do at the end of every podcast, I guess maybe one thing I should say is that I do have, because many people have emailed me that they love my life lessons, the life lessons I give at the end of these, some of these podcasts I make. And again, I'll continue to do that. But I actually started like a formal website called divineinterventionlifelessons.com. Again, many of you listening to this podcast, you know I'm a Christian. And there's just a lot of like good Bible-based teaching on there. The podcasts are all less than 10 minutes long. And basically in those podcasts, I, you know, talk about like a life lesson, something that's applicable to not just people in medicine, but pretty much people from every walk of life, right? So they are less than 10 minutes. I plan to make a couple every week. So far I've made 10. I'm going to be making an 11th one actually today. And you just listen to it, very short principle. Now just like principles I discuss that can help you like, you know, succeed in life, or just literally avoid troubles in life, or just deal with things that relate to like mental health in life, right? So if you're interested, it's called divineinterventionlifelessons.com. And then I also have the podcast on Apple Podcasts. If you look on Apple Podcasts and you look for Divine Intervention Life Lessons, you will find those podcasts. And then I do also offer one-on-one tutoring for the USMLE exams, step one, step two CK, step three, preclinical med school exams, third year shelf exams. Obviously the time I have is limited, right, to allocate to those, right? So most times you have to book with me ahead of time if you want to be able to see me one-on-one. And then I do offer these review courses for step 2 CK and step 3, and MBME test taking strategies course that, again, tons of people have taken and they found to be extremely helpful. I mean, I've had people attend my review courses and get scores around the 280s on the USMLE exams. And then I know that we are going through this ERAS cycle. So if you need help with personal statements, recommendation letters, your ERAS application, again, I do this at a flat rate. Just shoot me an email and I'll give you some more information on that. Again, I've worked with tons of people that have had very tricky applications, people that have red flags on the applications, people that have failed USMLE exams, people that don't have as much research as they should, right? I've worked with people, or people that have even graduated from med school 10 years ago, right? If any of these tricky things apply to your ERAS application, again, shoot me an email. I have a very good track record with people, especially people applying to like many different kinds of residencies, right? So I've worked with people going into dermatology, neurosurgery, plastic surgery, ENT, internal medicine, family medicine, OB-GYN, gen surg, urology. I've worked with people going into many different disciplines. So if you're interested in any of these things, just shoot me an email and I'll give you some more information. So, and also, you know, I have a website, obviously, right? DivineInterventionPodcast.com. If you go there and subscribe, you'll get an email notification whenever I make a new podcast. And I also have these podcasts on Apple Podcasts, on Google Podcasts, and on Spotify. At least the most recent 150. It's a WordPress rule. So if you want everything from like episode 1 all the way to 332, which is this one I'm making, then I'll strongly encourage you to consider I'll strongly encourage you to consider going on the website. You can find all of them there. Okay. So, and also have a YouTube channel called Divine Intervention USMLE Podcasts and Videos. That's where I put all the podcasts that all the video materials that I make. So, but if you want the slides associated with those videos, go on the website and search under those respective episodes. So thank you for listening to me. I really hope you found this podcast to be helpful. I'll see you next time. God bless you. Thank you.